Yeah, I'm making a wrong generalization, but I doubt there'll be too many prayers. I don't know that it was a religious service. My suspicion is that, as my dad would describe it, they're in front of the one-eyed God watching a football game. And I like football and like sports as much as anybody, but I really appreciate your being here tonight. And I'm convinced that you will be blessed for having been here, that God will bring a blessing in your life for your faithfulness to Him. And thank you for that example. I want to thank also Andrew Folks. Andrew got me down front before the sermon and said, you know, Kirk, you know, tonight we really need to send a message that God comes first in our lives. In fact, that's why all of us are here, not at home watching the ball game. And he said, Kirk, you know, I really don't think you should worry about that 636 rule I laid down. In fact, I think you should go a little longer just to emphasize that God is number one in our life. And so I just want to thank Andrew for that. And so if I go a little long tonight, you might want to thank Andrew for that. Or maybe it wasn't quite like that, Andrew. Maybe I misunderstood the conversation. But I'm glad you're here. And I'm glad Drew's here. And I'm glad he's my friend. And I'm glad that God is our friend. So look at Exodus 34. I do want to begin with something, I think, that's interesting to me about the game tonight, that I don't think is between Green Bay and Dallas, but between the Colts and the Bears. What's interesting has been, and I don't know how much folks who are here follow football, but to look at the careers of the two quarterbacks. I think most folks here know Peyton Manning because of his years of playing at Tennessee. But during his career, he's kind of been known as a guy who could put up great numbers in the regular season, but couldn't get it done when a championship was on the line. He couldn't pull it out in the big game. He'd throw a bunch of interceptions or something would happen. And so he would get to his chance to go to the Super Bowl and he would lose it. And so they thought, you know, he couldn't pull it through in the clutch. He could handle a regular season game. He could even handle a first round of the playoffs, but he couldn't handle the big game. Now, as you think about Rex Grossman, what's interesting about him is he doesn't have the story, the big career. He doesn't have all the big numbers of Peyton Manning. His time at being a starter is pretty recent. But as you look over his year, this past year, he had some weeks where he was literally the best quarterback in football. His ratings were over 100%, outstanding, unbelievable. But then he had other weeks where his numbers were hovering around zero in quarterback ratings, and was absolutely pitiful. So much so that for the second half of the season, there was a lot of discussion every week on all the talk shows on whether he ought to be replaced the next week. Now, why do I say that? Well, football doesn't matter. But since the folks are thinking about that tonight, you have two quarterbacks who could have been replaced. One coach should have said, hey, well, he can't get us through the big game. He gets us there, that's all well and good, but let's get somebody who can win the big game. Let's trade him. We can get some outstanding players for him. He might be more valuable to us as trade bait. Let's get rid of him because he can't win the big game. But they said, no, Peyton Manning's our quarterback, and we're going to give him another chance. We're going to keep him on the field. Lovie Smith, the coach of Rex Grossman, could have, when he had those terrible games, when he threw multiple interceptions and turnovers, he could have said, let's bring Greasy off the bench. Let's put somebody else behind center. There's no way Grossman's going to get us to the Super Bowl. But he didn't. Every week to the reporters, he said, this is my quarterback. And every week, he gave him another chance. What I'm trying to say is that two guys are playing in a game tonight because their coaches gave them second chances in spite of their mistakes. Now, what in the world does that have to do with us in Exodus 34? I'm convinced that the Bible teaches that we would not be here tonight, and someday we would not be in eternity if we did not have a God who was a God of second chances, who kept forgiving us, working with us, and putting us back to work in His kingdom in spite of our mistakes. And I believe the book of Exodus is a living illustration of that reality. It is a depiction of a God who kept forgiving His people, the God of second chances. We're going to focus on verses 1 through 9 tonight of Exodus 34, centering on the relationship between a human being and God. And we're going to see a man in a valley, a man on a mountain, and a man on his knees. And I believe much of what's going on, especially in chapters 32 through 34 of Exodus, is kind of a microcosm of the human condition in each of our individual relationship with God. And different people are at different stages along that journey. If we go back to chapter 32, there we find a people who've sinned against God. They've come to realize the consequences of their sin. Remember, they built the golden calf. God has said, "I'll wipe them out, Moses, and I'll start all over with you." So they've come to realize that they are sinners. And so out of that, they come to realize in chapter 33 the consequences of their sins. God says, "I'll not go with you into the promised land." And they mourned because of that. Moses would describe what that really meant when he said, "If you don't go with us, don't take us up from here." So you see a people longing for a restored relationship with God. They realize they're wrong. They realize the consequences of their sins, and they want the relationship restored. And that longing for a close relationship with God is most clearly depicted in the life of Moses. He didn't build the golden calf. Yet, he reveals most clearly and strongly that desire to see God. Remember, we finished last week by talking about that Moses, while the people were afraid of God, they wanted a relationship with God, but they were afraid of God and they wanted a small God they could understand. Moses wanted the full God. And he specifically, there are three things, it seems to me, and you might enumerate other things, but it seems to me what Moses says, he says, first of all, "God, forgive this people and go with us." And number two, Moses says in chapter 33, "I want to know your ways. I want to know you and what you're like and what your nature is." And number three, he says, "I want to see your glory. I want more of you. So forgive us and go with us. Help us to know your ways and let me see your glory." And so we ended last week at the end of chapter 33 with God granting that request. And so we see that being fleshed out in the beginning of chapter 34. Having said that, let's just read the first four verses and talk about the man in the valley. "Now the Lord said to Moses, 'Cut out for yourself two stone tablets like the former ones, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the former tablets which you shattered. So be ready by morning and come up in the morning to Mount Sinai and present yourself there to me on top of the mountain. No man is to come up with you, nor let any man be seen anywhere in the mountain. Even the flocks and the herds are not to graze in front of that mountain.' So he cut two tablets of stone like the former ones, and Moses rose up early in the morning and went up onto Mount Sinai as the Lord had commanded him, and he took two stone tablets in his hands." Moses is at the foot of the mountain. Moses has requested more of God's glory and to know God better. And so God invites him up on a mountain. Again, think of this process. The Israelites recognize their sin. They long for a restored relationship. That is depicted in Moses, who cries out for God's forgiveness of the people and wants more of God. And I believe that if a person wants to know God, if a person truly yearns for God with all of their being, they can find God. If you look over in the book of Acts, in Acts chapter 17, beginning in verse 26, it says, Acts 17:26, Paul says, "And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, that they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for Him and find Him, though He is not far from each one of us." God is looking for people who are looking for Him. And in Moses, He found a man who was looking for and longing for Him. And so He said to that man, "Come up on the mountain. Come up out of the valley. Come into My presence." Moses had had an encounter with God on the mountain and he wanted more. And so God gave him more. Often we get in life what we want. If we want more stuff, more possessions, more power, and we make that the pursuit of our life, we'll probably get some of it. But if, like Moses, we make the pursuit of our life to know God better, then that is what we'll get. And that's exactly what Moses got. Now, it's interesting, God asked him to recarve two tablets of stone. If we go back to the first two stone tablets, God made them. God made them and God wrote on them. And remember, the people broke the covenant that was written on the stone. And then coming down the mountain, when Moses saw they had broken the covenant, he broke the stone the covenant was written on. And so now God asks him to re-chisel out two stone blocks. Why did God have Moses do it this time? He doesn't say. It may be because he broke the last one. And so he had some responsibility for the broken stones and wanted him to make the new ones. Maybe some have said it was because he wanted to send a message that when human beings have sinned against God, there need to be human acts of penitence. And maybe that's connected to it. And I've heard some other explanations. When it's all said and done, I don't know. But I do know God asked him to recarve those stones so that God himself, with his own hand, could write upon those stones what we know as the Ten Commandments, or is often called the Ten Words or the Ten Sayings. Now, again, I don't know if we mentioned this a couple of months ago when we were looking at Exodus chapter 20, but my opinion from reading from some other folks, I personally believe that the reason there were two tablets was not so that you had five commandments on one and five on another, or six on one and four on another, or whatever. The reason I think that they had two stone tablets is because it was common practice in ancient treaties or covenants for both parties to be given a copy of the covenant. Okay, if there was a treaty between two nations, they worked out an agreement, they made two copies, one for each king or one for each kingdom. And so what you've got here is a covenant between God and human beings. My personal feeling is the reason you have two stones is you've got a copy of the covenant for God and a copy of the covenant for the people. And we know, for example, if we look in Deuteronomy 10, verse 5, we also can find that if we look over in 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 9, Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 4, just some places where it mentions that these tablets went into the Ark of the Covenant. Now that's interesting. If in these tablets you have a copy for man and a copy for God of the covenant between God and man, or at least God and Israel, why is it significant that it's put in the Ark of the Covenant and put in the tabernacle? Because the tabernacle was the place where the two people who made the covenant went to meet each other. Okay? God came down to that tabernacle, and when they came to sacrifice, and especially when the high priest went before God on the Day of Atonement, he went in to the very presence of God there before, on top of, seated on, so to speak, on the Ark of the Covenant. And so at that place where God and man came to meet one another, you had two copies of the document that described the covenant that they were making between one another. This is very, very significant. They want God's forgiveness. And what God is doing by that is He's saying, I'm giving you a second chance. I want you to realize that they have committed spiritual adultery against God. They're spiritual newlyweds. I want you to think about, you've just got married, and the week of your honeymoon or the week after, your spouse runs around on you. That's what they did to God. While He's on the mountain laying out the details of the law to Moses, they're down in the valley building a golden calf and calling it the God who let set them out of Egypt. So I want us to realize what a big deal this is. That God would forgive the bride who was unfaithful to Him. He could have divorced Israel. He could have written Israel off and started over with Moses. But He didn't. Because He's a God of second chances. Again, reading in verse 5. The Lord descended in the cloud and stood there with him as he called upon the name of the Lord. And then the Lord passed by in front of him and proclaimed, the Lord God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness and truth, who keeps loving kindness for thousands, who forgives iniquity, transgression and sin. Yet He will by no means leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquity of fathers on the children and on the grandchildren to the third and fourth generations. Remember what Moses asked for. He said, I want to know Your ways, and I want to see Your glory. So what does He do first? If you look there in verse 5, the Lord descended in a cloud. And literally what's happening, as Moses is calling out to God, God is coming to Moses. While he's calling on the name of the Lord, literally it's as if he's engulfed by God. God, the cloud comes down, literally it seems upon him and around him. He's there. It's pictured as being with Moses. He stood there with him, verse 5 said, as he called upon the name of the Lord. And the Lord's glory passed by in front of him. Remember, that's one of the things Moses asked for. I want to see your glory. So his glory passed by in front of him. But then remember, Moses also said, I want to know your ways. And so as God's glory passed by, God described his ways. Because God's ways flow out of His nature. He says, I am Yahweh. And that God's using His personal name. Okay? He's described sometimes as Elohim, Adonai, Lord, God, etc. But when He says Yahweh, those words that are in all capital letters, the word Lord in your Bible, He's using His own name. And He says, here's what I am. Here is my nature. Here's what I'm all about. And he lays out seven things that describe his nature. I want you to think for a moment about those seven things. First of all, he says, I am compassionate. It's a word that describes emotion, love, mercy, etc., that spring from the innermost part of a person. The emphasis is on deep-seatedness, feeling, emotion, connection. God is saying, I am connected to my people. I feel for my people. I hurt for my people. My love and compassion dwell and they swell from deep, deep inside of me. Isn't it amazing that the Creator of the universe, who needs absolutely nothing from us, can be moved in His innermost being by the needs of a simple human being? He says, not only is that, but He is gracious. And just as we would have that concept in the New Testament, the idea of it's meeting somebody's need and giving somebody what they need even though they have no right to it and do not deserve it. The reminder for each of us is, it doesn't matter what I do. It doesn't matter how many services I attend, how many times I read through my Bible, how many prayers I say, or how many people I help. I don't deserve to go to heaven. I don't deserve to be in the presence of God. I'm a sinner in the presence of an angry God. I can only find salvation because His nature is a nature of graciousness. He gives to those who do not deserve His gifts. The next thing He talks about is that He's slow to anger. And is there any more vivid example of this than what has just happened? Again, think of what you would feel like if your spouse was unfaithful to you. Think about if you're on your honeymoon and you found out your spouse has been unfaithful to you. Would you give them a second chance? God gave Israel a second chance. And if you read through the history of Israel in the Old Testament, time and again they provoked God's anger. But His nature, anger, is something that He expressed at times, but He was slow to express it. The idea here is of patience. Endurance, long-suffering, putting up with the weakness and frailties of others. Think of how we are, for example, in our marriage relationships. I mean, you know, after a month or two of them, you know, not leaving wet towels in the middle of the bed or maybe not putting the top on the toothpaste, you know, ready to take each other's head off. Yet think of all that Israel did to God. And yet God was patient and slow to anger. It also says, they abounded in loving kindness and truth. Loving kindness, in fact, it's the same word that he uses down here in verse 7. Verse 7, he says, who keeps loving kindness for thousands. The same word is used in both cases. Sometimes some translations will use two different words, but it's the same word. He abounds in a loving kindness which he expresses to thousands. Some think this may mean thousands of generations. But that word, loving kindness, is the word hesed in the Bible. And the word hesed is a very important word. It's often translated as love or mercy. It's the key Old Testament term. Like if you're in the New Testament and you want to describe God and how He treats people, you always hear the word agape. That's the word that always comes out. God's agape love. That's how He loves us. God so agape'd or loved the world He gave His only begotten Son. In the Old Testament, the primary term that describes God's nature of loving kindness and loyalty is chesed. And you see it all through the Old Testament. And again, it's often translated either as love, as mercy, as loving kindness, or loyal covenant faithfulness. The word loyalty and the word love are at the heart of this word. That He is a God who is loyal in His covenant relationships. He is a God who is faithful and dependable and who will be there when the chips are down. And it says He abounds in that, and that He expresses it to thousands. And it says not only does He abound in that, but He abounds in truth. That word truth has the idea of stability, dependability, something that is true and you can count on. That would describe His words, that would describe His nature, that would describe His promises, that would describe His actions. He is a God of stability. If He speaks something, it is stable, it is true, it is unwavering. When He talks about His nature here, it is a nature that is stable and true and unwavering. He's not this way one day and this way another day. But He's true, credible, and stable. It also says, number 6, that He is a God who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin. And we don't need to get caught up in the 3 different words He uses here. A lot of times if you read the Apostle Paul, a lot of times he'll pile up words to emphasize his point. We don't need to kind of ferret out all the differences in these words. The main point is that God forgives all kinds of sin, whatever you want to call it. Transgression, sin, God is a God who forgives. And this word forgive is the word nasal in their language, and it's a really neat word. It means to bear or to carry. It's a word that they could just use for carrying a pitcher of water from here to over there. But it was also a word that gained special significance when you look at it in terms of the book of Leviticus. Because God would talk about the sins of people, and He would basically say that they bear their sin, just like you might carry a rock across your front yard or carry a tire that you're going to put on your car, that we carry our own sins. But then when it describes what the priests do, it says when the priests make sacrifices for the people, it says that they bring about nasah. There's a sense in which the priests bear the sins of the people by offering sacrifices on their part. But in the Bible, it ultimately pictures God as the one who forgives, the one who nasahs, the one who carries their sin. And so the picture is I'm climbing up a hill to salvation. I want to go to heaven. I want to go to God. But I've got this huge burden on my back. I can't carry it. It weighs me down. I can't go one step farther. And I hear footsteps behind me and I turn around and God walks up and says, "Here, let me take that." And He throws it on His shoulder and He reaches and takes yours and He takes yours and He takes yours and He takes yours. And He puts them all on His back and said, "Follow me to the top of the hill." God carries my sin. He lifts that burden off of my back. He forgives. And as I think about all these that describe the God of second chances, I think about just tonight. I was coming from my house for worship services, and I'll be honest with you, I have lots of weaknesses. One of my pet peeves is tailgating. If I'm driving the speed limit, especially if there's somebody in front of me and I couldn't go faster if I wanted to, then you don't have to get in the car with me. Or if you do, you know, wave, honk your horn, and invite yourself in. Just don't run into the back end. And I remember thinking as I'm driving down the road how annoyed I am with this guy. He's so close, I can't even see his headlights. And just as I'm welling up this frustration and anger in me, I thought, you know, I'm going to talk about this tonight. Here I am mad at some guy driving down the road, and I'm going to walk in the building and talk about a God who forgave people for building a golden calf. Don't you think how quick we are to be angry and frustrated and mad, and we've got our own little pet peeves? Man, if God had pet peeves against us, there wouldn't be a chance for any of us, would there? And those 6 terms describe a God of second chances. But number 7 is also there. We want a one-dimensional view of God. Some people view God as all love. How could a God of love condemn anybody? Others view God as a God of all justice and punishment, and He's kind of out to get everybody. The picture of the nature of God that's described here is one of both. Of both mercy and justice. It says He will not allow those who do evil, who hate God, to go unpunished. It says to the 3rd and 4th generation. Now, as I look at that, does that mean God holds children responsible for the sins of their parents? Well, if you look over in Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verse 16, it specifically says you cannot punish a son for the sin of the father. That's very clear. So, what then is He saying? Well, what He might be saying is, just because God punished this generation for sin doesn't mean He'll let their kids away with it. Or one of the popular things in psychology today is to blame everything on your parents and your grandparents. I mean, that just kind of seems to be one of the glowing trends. In fact, it seems if you go to a counselor today, it's either biological, in other words, it's how you're made, and that's why you act like you do, or it's somehow family. You know, your mom did this, your dad did that, they didn't do this, they didn't do that, your grandparents didn't do that, and so it's their fault. You're not responsible. You just do the best you can to deal with the parents you had. Well, I think there's a possibility that what he's saying here is that I can't blame it on the generation before me, and I can't blame it on the generation before that. It doesn't matter how many generations the action is passed down, God still holds them accountable. Whatever it is exactly means that, it stands in contrast to what he's just said. Yes, God is a God of justice. God is a God who punishes sins, and with that there should be a horror of realizing that we will be held accountable. At the same time, we need to remember that the seventh description of God's nature is preceded by six, which all describe His love and His mercy. And that the punishing to four generations stands in contrast to the loving kindness shown to thousands of generations of God. And then in verses 8 and 9, it says, Moses made haste to bow down toward the earth and worship. He said, If I now have found favor in your sight, O Lord, I pray, let the Lord go along in our midst, even though the people are so obstinate, and pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us as your own possession. We saw the man in the valley. He was called up on the mountain with God. And then we saw the man on the mountain who stood with God and saw God and heard God's own description of His nature. What happens when that happens? It ought to drive us to our knees every single time. When he got what he wanted, it put him on his knees. He worshiped God. He praised God. But he still wanted more God because you notice what he said, Lord, please go with us. You see, when I realize my sin and I long for restored relationship with God and God grants me that relationship and I come to know Him and understand His nature of love and justice, then it should cause me to honor Him, lift Him up, and worship Him, and want Him in my life. That's exactly what Moses asked for. I want to ask you a question. When's the last time you were on your knees in front of God? When's the last time that you lay down on your face in your living room in the darkness of the night and cried and begged God to forgive you? When's the last time you knelt alone and sang praises to God? Or went to your knees and prayed to God, thanked Him for His goodness and asked for His help? We're so proud. We're so worried about what somebody else is going to think. We're so formal in our relationship with God. But yet when I look in the Bible, I find people falling to their knees all the time. I find people so awed with the greatness of God and their sin. They didn't worry what everybody else thought about them because they weren't thinking about people. They were only thinking about God. When's the last time that we looked at the greatness of God and it broke our hearts and drove us to our knees? Would you take out your psalm books and turn to the hymn of encouragement? As you turn there, I'm reminded that this past week, NASA had a number of bad anniversaries. If you go back to Saturday week ago, in the last week, if I understand this correctly, they had the 40th anniversary of the tragic flash fire that cost three astronauts when the command module burned up during a test. 40th year anniversary. It is the 21st anniversary of the Challenger accident, and this week was the 4th anniversary of the Columbia accident. All of those anniversaries they've had to work through in the last week. Why do I share that tonight? Because every one of those was an opportunity for them to quit. With every one of those said, we can't go on, the price is too high, the danger is too much. Yet they kept launching ships. As I look in the Bible over and over, I see a people who keep messing up what God's doing. I see a people who keep denying God, committing spiritual adultery, letting God down. And with each time, God could by right have said, no more. They don't deserve it. because His nature is a nature of loving kindness and forgiveness, God keeps launching the scheme of redemption. And it's only because He's that God who won't give up on us even when we deserve it that you and I have a reason to gather tonight. He is the God of second chances. And if you came tonight, if any of us, and we'd like a second chance, we'd like to become a part of His kingdom by expressing our faith in repentance, confession, and baptism. Or we realize that we have broken His heart by the sham of a life that we're living as a Christian of unfaithfulness to Him. Don't look at Him as a God who wants to destroy us. He wants us back because that's His nature. Please come to the God of second chances as we sing. God.